Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Band. And to get the week off to a good start, we're going to be talking art today, and more specifically art in New York. Joining me down the line from the Big Apple is Charlotte Burns, Senior Editor at Art Agency. Charlotte, welcome to the programme and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you, Rob.
Thanks very much. Now, I love your choices. It's a triple threat of shows that aren't going to be on for too much longer, in fact. January is sort of everyone's last chance to get and see these guys, isn't it? We're going to start, Charlotte, at the Met. This is Kerry James Marshall, a big retrospective, an important artist. How good is this show?
This show is magnificent. You should run to it and go and see it as many times as you can before it closes. It's really, really a fantastic, powerful, meaty, fun, thoughtful, emotional show.
Well, this is fantastic. Is it too late to get all these quotes on the poster?
I'm probably not the person that people want quoted, but I would definitely recommend it.
And it's interesting stuff. I mean, Kerry James Marshall is a black artist born in Birmingham, Alabama. He references this a lot. I mean, his art sort of is first and foremost about that, or you might think it is. He puts himself or his characters into art history, doesn't he? And he kind of plays with our very traditional classical readings of old works. Talk us through a bit of his process, the kind of stuff we can see on the walls, if we do, as you have suggested, and run to the Met.
Well, Kerry James Marshall is first and foremost a fantastically talented painter. You know, the way that he handles paint, the way he handles his media, combines different genres, themes. He's realistic, he's fantastical, and all of this lives at once in a canvas or on whatever it is that he's painting on, and looks cohesive and makes sense. And that's a major skill in the first place, to have so many different styles competing and each have its own space in the picture plane. His technical ability is really stunning, and aside from that, his subject matter is unique because he takes the idea of the black American and the history and their body and inserts it into the grand style of, you know, it's essentially European painting. So he takes history painting as a starting point, and he puts black people inside. He has this, I think he called it the grand style.
Yeah.
And he creates these really fantastic works that are to do with the idea of blackness often. One of his works from 1980 is a portrait of the artist as a shadow of his former self. And he was thinking about Ralph Ellison's 1952 novel, The Invisible Man, in which the African-American hero is aware that the fact that his skin color makes him unseeable as a person within the context of largely white America. And so Kerry James Marshall takes this idea and paints a self-portrait which is very recessive because everything is black. There's a black figure sensed against a black background. But there's different shades and nuances within there. And stepping out from the kind of gloom are the eyes, a gap-toothed smile, and a peak of a shirt. So he takes this idea of how seen and unseen African Americans are within the culture of America and reinserts them. And he does that in several different ways, whether he looks at housing projects. He grew up in one, and he actually has very fond memories of that, though points to the dereliction that would come in later years. He has barbershop images, which are somewhat heroic whilst colloquial. And then he has history paintings, such as a sort of portrait of Nat Turner with the head of his master about the slave who famously slain his master.
And thanks for telling us about both of the things there, because, you know, I kicked off saying he's a black artist. He's masterly at depicting the things that he shows, but he is far more than that. He is a fantastic artist in any respect. This is a big deal show. I mean, it was a big year for all sorts of statements of intent, from Beyonce to Kendrick to Lamar to Frank Ocean. Kerry James Marshall kind of wraps up all of the over and underbelly of a lot of intelligent, brilliant black art in 2016. And as I say, not wanting to diminish it as something that is black art, but there is something about that, almost tying up all of those thoughts very eloquently in this show that opened last autumn, right?
Well, there's a sadness to it too, in a way that I think I remember reading in the catalogue, which is a great publication. There's something about the moment that we were living in, and this catalogue was clearly written before the election, because, you know, these things have to be in order to happen when the show's open. So I think the curators must have been looking at a moment in history and thinking we were in the middle of a second civil rights movement, or at least a continuation of the first. And Kerry James Marshall was born at the beginning of the first civil rights movement. He remembers the Watts Towers protests. He grew up in LA at a point where that was happening. He's very much rooted in the history of African Americans and their civil rights within the US. So when this catalogue was being prepared, when this exhibition was being prepared, there was probably more optimism and hope than there currently is, with the president-elect being inaugurated later this month, with a completely different agenda than the one I think people felt we were on, and that America is perhaps on a different path now. So I personally felt sort of great optimism and a deal of sadness when I was at the show, because you feel that there's this moment where these voices were having a voice, and it wasn't marginal, it was very central. And I am personally curious as to the extent to which that will continue.
Okay, beautifully put, Charlotte. Thank you very much. That is Kerry James Marshall. The show's called Mastery, and it's on at the Met until the 29th of January. We're going now to something much sparer, starker, but none less beautiful, perhaps. Agnes Martin, this is on the Guggenheim. Talk us through this one, Charlotte. It is a swing away from Kerry James Marshall's show, isn't it?
It's a swing away, but it's another epiphany. I was thinking about Agnes Martin this morning and what to say to you on the radio.
I know you love Agnes
Martin.
Me, yeah.
I love Agnes Martin, yeah. But I didn't understand Agnes Martin for years, and so now I love her with the passion of a convert, because I remember going to see an exhibition of hers at Deer Beacon, which is a museum in upstate New York, about 10 years ago, and I didn't understand her work. And then I just stood in front of it and looked at it in this kind of calm, quiet exhibition space, and had a come to Agnes moment where I understood her work. I understood that it's emotional, it's not austere. I understood that it's my opinion of minimalism and abstraction was wrong and too linear, even though this is a linear work. I hadn't understood the vibrations of this work and all the feeling that goes into it and the way that it makes you feel. And the problem with Martin is that it doesn't reproduce very well. And in this age of ours where we look at things on a screen constantly, there's not much screen power, because her work is ostensibly limited tonally. There's its whites and greys with kind of quiet hums of pastel colours usually.
And there's something interesting in that as well. Is there something about the scale of these works as well, Charlotte, that makes them sort of unreproducible, that makes them not a happy postcard kind of thing, or not a happy Instagram post? Are they large canvases generally?
They're large. She painted sort of the human scale, sort of these grids that are 6 foot by 6 foot often. And then there was very clear sizes. So in a way, she actually anticipated Instagram, because she paints a format that we're used to seeing things in, this sort of square grid. It's just more the color palette, and you don't get the strength of the work when you see it reproduced on print media or on a screen, wherever really, even in a catalog, it's very, very hard. And she felt strongly that you should look at her work and contemplate it for several minutes. And much of her effort was into capturing the sense of beauty and happiness that comes in observing the world through a clear landscape. And she has this great passage that I was reading this morning in an essay by her, which I'm going to read to you, which is so sort of beautiful. She says, "When a beautiful rose dies, beauty does not die, because it's not really in the rose. Beauty is an awareness in the mind. It's a mental and emotional response that we make. We respond to life as though it were perfect. When we go into a forest, we do not see the fallen, rotting trees. We are inspired by a multitude of uprising trees. We even hear a silence when it's not really silent. When we see a newborn baby, we say it is beautiful. Perfect. The goal of life is happiness, and to respond to life as though it were perfect is the way to happiness. It is also the way to positive artwork."
Well, it's beautiful stuff. In the fortnight that John Berger has also passed away, I think that is equal to the man himself, right, as well?
Yeah, it's this idea of, for her, she suffered a lot with mental health problems. She didn't even become a painter till she was 30. She dropped out of painting for a period when she went wandering around the desert, and then returned mysteriously, never explaining why, because she didn't really want to be pigeonholed by biological circumstances. So there's a lot of mystery to her life and work. And the great thing about this show is that it gives you a broader view than you necessarily had before, because she's a ruthless editor of her work. She purged works that she didn't think ultimately fit in with her end goal view because it shifted. It took her a while to identify the grid as her means of communication. So what you see here are surprises. There are these sort of biomorphic forms at her early career. You see when she moved to New York after being discovered by the art dealer Betty Parsons, the very clear influence of her friends and close neighbors, such as you see that a canvas in the show is directly influenced by Rothko. And then you also see this sort of moment of bling where she does a kind of grid in gold leaf, which is called Friendship and is the quietest gold leaf work I've ever seen. And then you see her progressing into the works that we know and admire her for, and kept working and ceaselessly, you know, in her 80s and 90s, she was still producing works that surprised her. She produced these works that had triangles in that she said scared her. So it's kind of an amazing commitment to art.
None of us want our money back from the Agnes Martin Show at the Guggenheim. But hurry, you have only until January the 11th. Charlotte, you're finishing by telling us about Francis Picabia. This is at the MoMA in New York. Thank you also for correcting my pronunciation of his surname. I've been going around for maybe not a long time, but 2 or 3 years when I see his work turning up at art fairs saying how much I love him. No one has told me it sounds like I'm ordering a beer. So thanks for that. Let's talk our listeners who might be unfamiliar with this name and the kind of guy he was. Tell us a little bit about Francis Picabia.
Well, Picabia is very difficult to pin down. He was mercurial and didn't really stick to a style long enough for anybody to necessarily get a grips of him. So the thing that's so great about this show is that you realize there's about, 33 different Picabias. And each one of them was serious and unserious. It was taking, what's the best way of putting this? He used to take movements that other people dedicated their lives to and use them as just another tool in the toolbox. So for him, you know, expressionism was a means to an end. For him, collage was something you could do. History paintings were something you could look at. Porn was something you took as inspiration. And he combined everything. It's high and it's low and it's broadened, it's skinny, it's sort of everything. It's like a kaleidoscope that you just shift one way and then another and you see totally different things. So for that reason, a lot of people don't actually know Picabia because you can't really grab him by the scruff of his neck and figure out what he was about.
In an art historical way, is it difficult to put him into where people like to put people into pigeonholes and then extrapolate truths and biography from artists and from their work? Is he difficult to kind of get and to kind of love because he has so many different things rolled into one? And I also wonder whether his sort of dalliance with certain styles is taken as a sort of lack of seriousness.
I think that's certainly true. It's much easier to understand someone if they're consistent. And, you know, that's true in art and in life. And Picabia was not consistent in anything other than his inconsistency. And he was a man of wealth. He didn't need to do anything other than create art. He loved fast cars. He loved women. I think he constantly had a wife and at least one or two mistresses who all usually got along pretty well. And he dipped in and out of different movements. He's, you know, obviously very closely associated with Dada. But he infuriated the Impressionists, whose, you know, theory was obviously that everything should be painted en plein air, outside, and he would take postcards and copy them, which was, you know, purposefully irritating to those kind of grandmasters. And he did great jobs, and then he took Cubism and created these muscular images. He moved into Dada, he moved into, there's these monster paintings. He's just really moved all around the place, and it's very hard to pin him down, and I think that was very much purposeful. And he reminds me of Sigmar Polka, who's another artist whose reputation hasn't ever been fully understood because it was so purposefully iconoclastic and diverse. So it's a beauty of Picabia's work is that he's so wildly inventive and different, and yet that makes him difficult to understand. So that's why this show is so helpful, because it's sprawling and it's this sort of monstrous vision, and it's spread out larger, over 200 works. And you go through, I mean, they include drawings and works on video, there's carpets. It's incredibly diverse output.
Yeah, and do the curatorial notes, do the wall notes, the wall texts sort of help piece together the reputation and the mind of a man who probably had his mind on a million things?
Yes, certainly. They definitely do. The exhibition is really great, you know, because it gives you this, it's not just an overview, it's a very thorough overview where you get to see, you know, a small sample of all these different kinds of works. It's just like looking at several different artists. But again, here, if we go back to the issue of his actual technical ability, he's, you know, a really fantastic painter, even as he seems to be mocking the idea of individuality or the seriousness of certain movements. His hand can't help but be, you know, a serious painterly hand, and to have the strength and vigor behind that. So what could just be pastiche is actually great art because of the form he gives his jokes.
I love Francis Picabia. He could almost, on his headstone, could almost be, it's only paintings, isn't it? something of the amusing playboy, the dilettante about him, and also, as you say, someone that could not escape the fact that he was an exceptionally talented painter at the same time. And that Francis Picabia show is on until March the 19th. You have a little bit longer. You can walk slower to that one. Before that, Charlotte Burns talked us through Agnes Martin. It's on at New York's Guggenheim until January the 11th. And Kerry James Marshall, of course, Mastery, is on until January the 29th at the Met. So my thanks to my guest, Charlotte Burns. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. The show is produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when Laura Snapes will be here to review the week in music. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.